Okay, I'm sure people will trickle in, but let's get started. Hello, everybody. Thanks for coming. I know people are going to trickle in, but my name is Jody Rachens, and I'm the Director of Disability Services, and I'm excited to have us here for the second annual UML Stories of Disability. And this is something that has been a wonderful event, and we're excited to have a new group of panelists this year. And there are lots of folks online, so we have kind of a mixed presence. So we're going to do our best to capture everybody. Just want to tell you a little bit about this event. So why do we tell stories? I took this from poet Amanda Gorman. For millenniums, humans have told stories to connect, relate, and weave imaginative truths that enable us to see one another more clearly with compassion and courage. Finding empathy is a difficult challenge, but also the most human of the reasons we tell stories. We tell stories because we are human, but we are also made more human because we tell stories. When we do this, we tap into an ancient power that makes us and the world more of who we are. A single race looking for reasons, searching for purpose, seeking to find ourselves. Another one is storytelling is also the gateway to truth-telling, which helps inform our opinions, decision-making, and self-views. Sharing our stories allows us to come together, declare what our values are, and act on them. Without stories, we would not have the layers of history that impact our present and influence our future. And this is actor Wendell Pierce. And for me, telling a story about disability is not fearless. It's likely with fear, but it's necessary and it's brave. And because it's necessary, we tell our stories. And these are our storytellers today, but I'm going to let them introduce themselves to you as they take over. So I can, little clunky. Okay.
Hi, everyone. Thanks, Jody. I really appreciate the opportunity to share my experience with you all today. So my name is Justin Lawler. My pronouns are he, him, his, they. I'm the director of campus recreation. I've been working at UMass Lowell for 18 years, 1 year as a grad student, and then 17 years in the department for campus rec. So today, I really appreciate the opportunity to tell my story and share my experience. I'd say my experience with disabilities is complicated, but probably not, you know, unique, although there's some differences, I'm sure, as we kind of hear the different panelists. You know, for me, on a personal level, I've suffered from anxiety since I was a little child. It's really helped me, made me avoid social situations in my life. And even right now talking, I talk in front of hundreds of people about the work I do, and I don't get anxious. And even right now in this moment, I'm anxious telling my story. And those who know me might find it odd because they would probably say that I'm outgoing. I'm very much comedic in how I talk. But I do have a serious side. And I think, you know, that's really shaped my life, the anxiety that I've dealt with. I do enjoy actually being alone more than being around others and being independent. I selectively choose social situations that I put myself in. I think the biggest thing with anxiety is the fear of making mistakes and hurting other people, or just feeling that sense of disappointment when you do something that's not perfect. And so my nature is just to avoid conflict. And it's funny, as the director of a department, you have to address conflict, and in various leadership roles, you know, I've had to do that and have gotten better at it, but it's not definitely my nature to do that. From this, I've struggled with self-confidence, and part of the reason I feel like my anxiety might have been exacerbated is my family moved a lot when I was younger. I moved upwards of 30 times before the age of 16, and in and out of school systems. I was homeschooled for about 5 years from grade one to grade five, so constantly going in and out of school systems, being the new kid, you know, really isolating myself and, you know, not having the tools necessary at that point to be able to handle some of the situations I was in. So I always felt like I was behind, always trying to catch up. And that really just kind of, again, contributed to my anxiety issues that I had. So I would say, what has helped for me? Definitely others who noticed me that made me feel seen and heard, and therapy. Those are the two big things, and exercise, which I'll get into. So I do want to walk through a little bit of my family dynamics and how that played into some of the things that I've seen and witnessed. So my dad was bipolar, was undiagnosed most of his life. My mom had depression, which was a struggle when she was homeschooling me. Oftentimes we wouldn't even have class because of issues she was dealing with. And so as a young child, you don't understand a lot of these things, and it really impacted relationships. And we didn't actually have diagnosis for either of them until after I moved out of my house. So I didn't have a good example of necessarily to find the right tools or who to talk to. But that definitely impacted our family dynamics. My dad's bipolar was very extreme. It was an interesting way to grow up. So at age 16, I ended up moving out of my house due to some of the relationship issues that I had, moved in with my sister, who then immediately was diagnosed with a rare form of bone cancer called Ewing sarcoma. So the first year out on my own, as like a sophomore in high school, living with my sister, trying to navigate school and help her with her appointments in Boston, that was really challenging for me. And, had a major impact, I'd say, the end of my junior, senior year, and even into my early 20s, dealing with that and her eventual death and coping with that. And so even I talk about it, I get emotional. Other than that, I would say that was my first introduction to therapy was probably from situational depression from my sister passing away. I did it for about 6 months. And honestly, I should have continued at that moment. I was like, okay, I feel like it was more of an inconvenience. I had to go there. My schedule, I was working 3 jobs at the time. And I wish I would have continued at that moment. And it definitely later on in my life, I think would have helped me with things that have subsequently happened. But at 19, I was back on my own living again. By myself, and I was on the verge of dropping out of college. I was working at a nursing home in a kitchen, and I loved cooking. I loved food. And it was funny, my supervisor, his wife was the director of nursing, and my sister, who had passed away, was a CNA who had worked for her, and she really liked my sister, and she offered for me to move into their house. So as a 19-year-old male moving into a house of literally strangers that I knew for 3 months, they had 2 young daughters. One was 1 and 1 was 5. I was just so gracious and grateful. It's the first time I ever took help in my life that I really was like, I need help, because I feel like I was on the verge of not completing my degree and leading to a successful life that I feel like I have now. Through that process, living with that family, the 1-year-old was diagnosed with autism, and she was nonverbal until 4. I lived with that family for 7 years to get through college and helped me really get my life back on track. But I learned sign language, helped her with speech therapy, and learned a lot about autism that I just didn't even know, the entire spectrum and what that actually meant. So I feel like that really educated me on how to be a more empathetic person. And honestly, it set my life on a course that today I feel like I'm just so grateful of that experience that I had. I would say in my mid to late 20s, when I moved back out on my own, I still struggled mightily with anxiety, and then definitely different bouts of depression situationally. I went through a really bad relationship breakup in my 30s, and that really was challenging. Another avenue I turned to was exercise. I am in recreation. It might not be a surprise that I like helping others live happier and healthier lives. And for me, I really turned to exercise during some of those really critical moments in my life. Somewhat unhealthy at a certain point when I was really struggling, but it subsequently turned around in a positive way. I like to hike. I hiked, I think it was upwards of 60 mountains one summer and about 250 miles in 14 days. So I really like challenges, and really just I'm hyper-focused on accomplishing goals. And through that experience, I learned a lot about myself, meeting others who I met along the trail, and have continued my passion of running in general and hiking. That was really helpful, but in my mid-30s is when I really started to dive into therapy. I found the right therapist for me. I was with them for over 6 years. They recently retired, but I feel like the experience of meeting with a therapist, even when you're not going through challenges in life, is critically important, because I feel like you're more receptive to learn when you're a hard spot and you're going through something that's acute, it's hard to focus on anything else. And so therapy definitely helped me work through some of those challenges. But I would say when you're more clear-headed and through some of those harder situations, continuing to put tools in your tool bag to be effective in life and is really, really important. And so, you know, during that period, I think I went every other week for 6 years. It subsequently moved to monthly. And then recently, again, my therapist retired, which I was really sad. So I'm on the hunt for a new therapist. And I openly talk about it, where I feel like I grew up in the 80s. That wasn't something we talked about at all. So for me talking about it, I feel proud. And, you know, I feel like UMass Lowell is a place that people openly talk about these things to help students and other faculty and staff. So to close up, I would say, you know, therapy really for me was a way to challenge myself in a healthy way, combat negative thoughts, relax and think clearer. Identifying when you're anxious for me is half the problem. I get this feeling and this sense that comes over my body, recognizing that that's okay, you're feeling it, and then having tools to kind of combat that. And now I'm more apt to go into social situations, put myself out there, tell my story, because I feel like it not only helps me, it gets easier the more you talk about it, and then you can help others. And then it's really helped me be able to lead and manage others as a team and hold leadership positions and thrive in life and hold longer term relationships, which I really struggled with. Again, going back to moving all the time and not being able to really hone in on those social skills that I feel like I didn't have. I do want to say that it's not perfect and it's not linear. There's some good days, there's bad days. But, you know, I feel like the takeaways for me are really just, I feel like I can go into a room and I really look at identifying who might not feel included from the people that I've been around in my life, my family, these experiences, and look at how can I help them? How can I make them feel included? And so I hope by sharing my experience, maybe you learn something, or, you know, you have a similar situation and you can relate and it helps you moving forward. So thank you for letting me share.
Thank you. I'm going to acknowledge that it's awkward that you have to look at a big picture of yourself when you talk, and that there's a little bit of a lag for those that are looking up there, but this is for a recording for folks later.
I'm going to probably not look here quite as much, so apologies to the folks online, but my name's Beth. I'm the Assistant Director of Career Services, and I am not talking about me today. I have the pleasure of talking about my two girls, Lily, who's 3.5, and Thea, who is 1.5. Lily and Thea are my favorite ladies on the planet. They are funny, and they are spunky, and they are mischievous, and they are trouble. But they are also two girls who have a really kind of unique path through this life. They both have a rare genetic disorder called Gould syndrome. And Gould syndrome affects the collagen production in our body. And collagen is like the glue that holds us together. So it's a multi-organ disorder. Folks with Gould syndrome can have impacts to the brain, heart, kidneys, eyes, among other areas in their body. And Gould syndrome was only discovered in 2015, so there's not a lot of research on it yet. But for my girls, their largest impact was to the brain. Both of them had strokes when they were in utero, and that's left them both with differing intensities, I guess, of cerebral palsy. So a little bit about cerebral palsy and what that actually means. It is the most common lifelong motor disability. And to that point, until having Lily and Thea, my husband and I had not met someone with cerebral palsy. Motor disability for people with cerebral palsy can range from minimal to profound. And the condition is permanent. It's not something that you grow out of, though therapies can certainly help with symptoms. In addition to motor impacts from cerebral palsy, folks with this diagnosis can experience communication challenges, seizures, impaired vision, hearing loss, speech and language disorders, pain, and a myriad of other symptoms. And a single person might experience all of this. A single person might experience just some of this. How mild or severe it is really varies person to person. So if you've met a person with cerebral palsy, you've met a person with cerebral palsy. And I think it's that way for a lot of disabilities and disorders. And so while cerebral palsy is not progressive, meaning that it's not going to get worse over time, it's going to look different over time. So for an example, both girls were born newborn normal. However, signs of their CP started to show as they started to miss or struggle with developmental milestones. And as they hit major body changes, like going through puberty and growth spurts, their symptoms can be exacerbated over time. So that's something that's on our radar to help them through. Even just between Lily and Thea's cerebral palsy looks incredibly different. Lily has a diagnosis of mild spastic hemiplegia, meaning that when she had her stroke, it only affected one side of her brain. And so only one side of her body is impacted by that. When she started in PT, we didn't know if she was going to be in PT forever. We didn't know if she was just going to be in PT for a short period of time. And we've been really excited to see that between physical therapy, occupational therapy, and recreational activities like dance and gymnastics, Lily's made really great gains over time, to the point where a lot of the times we say, you know, if you didn't know, you wouldn't know that she had it. And there are big pros and cons to that. It's a pro because that means Lily gets to go through this life in a way that's largely just like her peers. However, she still is very much impacted by this. So if you can think about, like, if one of your hands was an oven mitt and now you have to button your shirt and you can never take that oven mitt off. She's gained a lot more control of the left side of her body, but she still has that sort of challenge. And that might not be something that she ever fully gains control of. And because she appears like a typically developing child, sometimes it's easy to forget that she needs a little bit longer. She might need a little bit of a different way to do something, but she can get there. And if she can't get there, she'll let us know. She's not shy to do so. But for Thea, her impact is a lot more significant. Thea's strokes impacted both sides of her brain. So while she also has a diagnosis of spastic cerebral palsy, she is impacted in all of her limbs and her whole body. So because we knew about Thea's strokes when I was still pregnant, we were able to be really proactive about getting her care. So she started physical therapy when she was just 4 weeks old, and we added on occupational therapy and speech therapy when those became appropriate. She even this January went through an intensive occupational therapy where they had to cast her stronger side so that she could finally develop the use of her weaker side, which she really didn't have any function in yet. And it made a big difference, but we also had the experience of everyone seeing her in a cast and wondering what's wrong. And it was kind of a big preview to what life might look like for her. She's 1.5 and taking her out and people seeing her still inching around on her tummy on the floor instead of walking. We do get the question of what's wrong. And that's something that we're going to have to help her figure out how to navigate through her life. And something that I think gets lost in that is that they both are just very normal kids. Like, it can look, for Thea in particular, so different, but she is just as silly and just as annoying to her sister and just as cognizant and curious as any other kid her age. And that's something that we're trying to help educate the other people in our life about. And when people do ask what's wrong, we really do try to take the opportunity to teach them a little bit and help Lily and Thea learn how to talk about it themselves and know that it's not something that they need to hide or be ashamed of. And if they don't know what's going on, they can't be their own advocates as they grow. But it's a lot of work being Thea. She has about 4 appointments a week. She still can't speak, though she does have a few basic signs. She does a lot of pointing and a lot of head shaking, and she lets us know what she wants. But we don't know if she'll speak. We don't know if she's going to need a communication device. We're pretty sure she'll walk, but we know it's going to look different from other people, at least at first. And that's okay. Again, like, her life is otherwise really very normal. It's just the way in which she navigates through it looks different from other people. And that doesn't make her life or Lily's life pitiable. they are wonderful. They are true miracles, these two. And what they've taught us is that all of this really is just stuff. They are people, just like everybody else is people. Do they get frustrated when they can't do something the way that they see their cousins can? Yeah, sure. Do we anticipate they're going to be treated unfairly? Probably. But we've learned that there's the equal amount of joy in this as there is for everybody else. But something that I think is really important to share about my girls and about a lot of people with cerebral palsy is that having a movement or a language disorder doesn't mean someone has a cognitive disorder. They are with it. They are smart and they score exactly where they should be for their age, for their cognition, and for their social skills. And so we are giving them every opportunity to try everything that they want to do. And we want to make sure that they are getting to interact with peers in the same way that kids their age get to interact. CP is dealt with in such a tender way at the pediatric level. However, even though it's a lifelong impairment, it's not something you grow out of, adult medicine is significantly lacking in CP experts. And so that's something that my husband and I are advocating for. We do a lot of work with trying to increase the research and the education around the adult CP space, because while it is going to be Lily and Thea's responsibility to figure out how to talk about their CP and also to figure out how much of their identity it is. It is a part of them. It will always be a part of them. They get to decide if it's part of how they identify themselves. But it shouldn't be their responsibility to educate healthcare providers. What we hope as they go through life is that when they're meeting people who consider themselves to be allies, that allies will do the work of doing just a little bit of research themselves. There's so much on the internet about cerebral palsy. So we are teaching them to talk about it. Lily's learning how to talk about her stroke and what that means and what cerebral palsy is. But if you meet someone with CP, you do a teeny bit of homework when you go home. Google the Cerebral Palsy Foundation and see what it's about, just to get the lay of the land so people don't have to educate from the very beginning. We try to provide the space for the hard, because again, it is hard. It's a lot more work, but by and large, those hard parts, the challenge is a sliver of life, most of life for two girls with a diagnosis of CP is very like anyone else's. It's just the methods are a little bit different. So yes, they have to work harder. Yes, there are a lot more appointments. Michael is putting some information in the chat for everyone. He's so reliable for it. But they really are just kids. And so what I hope people kind of take away from this is that when you meet someone with any sort of disability, don't assume what their experience is like. Do some education so you know the lay of the land, but give them the opportunity to let you know what their experience is and treat them like you'd treat any other human. And if you have the pleasure of seeing my kids running around this building, because they do come on a pretty regular basis, you can probably catch us playing mini golf and squealing at everybody. So thank you all for your time. Thanks for learning about them. And yeah, I'm gonna pass the computer along.
Righty. Hi, everyone. My name is Phoenix. I am, my pronouns are they, it. I am a clinical psych major and a creative writing major, and I'm the LGBTQ peer leader in the Office of Multicultural Affairs. I have a little bit of a different story, mostly because I have multiple disorders. So when I grew up, my mother was, she had a gastric bypass surgery, and most of the patients that the surgeon had dealt with had passed away. So my mother was left with barely any function at all. She was kind of like just a ghost in my presence a lot of the time. And that sort of led me to be taking care of my grandparents, who were not the best people. And that resulted in PTSD from a really early on place in life. And I also grew up always knowing that I had ADHD. So in my little hometown, we were the town that sort of pretended to be perfect. People with disabilities weren't treated as fairly as the rest. So I grew up having barely any support in those school settings that I was in, until about second grade, where I moved away from my grandparents with my mom, and she was trying her best to be a single mother, and support her children. But, during that time, I had a lot of behavioral issues, that were not being treated very well. So I was physically fighting people. I was not the kindest human being. And so they changed what my class looked like. So I would basically have the little stars on a sheet of paper. Like, if you do good every day this week, you get another star. And at the end of the week, you can go and do something fun. My fun thing was usually, playing with the little foods with the assistant principal of the school. And that was my first experience with having someone directly help me with things and help me regulate my emotions. But halfway through the year, we ended up moving because I was getting severely bullied, and so was my brother. My brother had pretty severe autism, was nonverbal till about 3 years old. He was also deaf in the beginning because of the fluid in his ears. So I basically went to all of his classes as well. I was just trying to be an amazing sister, I guess. But then, as time went on, my mother started to gain her memory back. She lost about ages 7 to 14 years of memory. And she didn't remember any of my milestones, didn't remember barely anything about me. So that created sort of a disconnect. But then eventually, as I went back to my old school, it was still the second grade classroom. They started implementing some, like, those little spiky chairs that I used to love. And they started actually caring about how I was not succeeding. And they started pulling me out of class. They started trying to give me speech therapy, occupational therapy. And that really helped. And then moving on to high school, I went to a tech school. I graduated from the nursing assistant program. It was a very toxic environment. It was detrimental to both my physical and mental health. It got to the point where I was having panic attacks every day, at least 5 times a day. And I would end up leaving class. I had on my IEP, I had permissions to text my therapist whenever I needed, and to leave class whenever I needed. But the teachers they seemed to not care. They just kind of ignored my IEP. And that sort of brought me to the point where I needed to stick up for myself. So I got used to being like, hey, I need extra help. And eventually it was, I was in my math class, and suddenly I started to feel an intense pain in my lower back. And it got to the point where I could barely move without significant pain. So I was dismissed. I stayed on the couch for 2 days. And my mother, who is a nurse, was helping me. But when I went back to school, I realized that things needed to change. So I communicated with my professors, my teachers, and told them, hey, there's something going on with my back. I don't know what it is, but I'm going to need like a place where I can just stand in the back or sit down and alternate between those two. So luckily they were kind enough to give me that. I started walking with my cane, not very often, mostly because I was sort of ashamed to be using it because my disability is invisible. People would look at me and be like, oh, you're walking with a cane for this reason. But so I ended up going through that. And then I decided that I was going to talk about it with my doctor. I went in, we had a regular physical. They figured out that it wasn't sciatica, but they just gave me the diagnosis of chronic pain. And they said, it's probably because of your weight. So you need to lose at least 10 pounds and go from there. I went on a diet, all vegetarian, for 6 months, and it did nothing. I was still in the same amount of pain that I was in the beginning. It had gotten at least a little bit better, but it really depends on what days flare up. But my therapist was really a big help in advocating for me if I really like needed it and felt like I couldn't do it myself. I've had the same therapist since I was six. She diagnosed me with depression and anxiety. I was able to sort of overcome my depression after a while. And then later on, I realized that something isn't right here. So I was, I didn't feel like myself and I felt like a different person. And I was writing out little phrases that just said like, hi, I'm this name. Hi, I'm this name. And they all looked like different writing. So what I have is called OSDD, otherwise specified personality disorder, otherwise specified dissociative disorder. It's a subcategory of DID, which is dissociative identity disorder, which means I have multiple different identities in my head. Right now we're at 65. So that became a big struggle as I was switching throughout people throughout the day. Luckily, we have the type where we can remember separate bodily experiences, but that really became hard as I was navigating communicating that, and my family was kind of just like, you definitely don't have that. And at that point, I really wanted to figure out what was going on in my brain. So I talked to my therapist about it, and it took me 4 years to get the official diagnosis because my therapist didn't feel comfortable. She didn't know enough on it. So I started sending her links to the professional websites that were about OSDD. And then through that, we were able to make a plan for me and try and see if I could manage, which luckily I have. Luckily we don't switch as much anymore. But how this has affected me in college, I was lucky enough to figure out that I needed to contact disability services early. I felt like I didn't have the diagnosis that I would need to be able to get services. But I just saw the little chronic pain thing. I submitted it. I think I emailed Evelyn and I was just like, hey, I don't know if this is like enough to have this sort of service. And luckily enough, they were so kind and helpful to me. And I was able to get a stationary desk and separate chair that really helps my flare ups. But yeah, so that's the story.
Hello everyone. That was really beautiful, Phoenix. I'm Fahad Alden. I currently work as a disability peer coach and as a well-being leader. And I'm currently a digital media student and an English with a concentration in theater arts. And this is my last semester as I enter grad school. My relationship with disability was very complicated. I'm Middle Eastern. So in our culture, disability and mental health is something that people really don't talk about. It's not, you know, conversations are not as open as they are in the US. So when I was in special ed, it was very hard for my parents to kind of understand my disability. And also there was a lot of ableism within my classmates that were in special ed. Because we were also insecure about it, it became a thing where we were putting ourselves down or putting people who needed more support down. And it was something that was really hard because when people label you as something, like sometimes our teachers would be like, that's the problem child, or that's the child that needs supports. And these labels were attached to me that I felt like, what is the point of trying, or what is the point of working hard if I'm going to be labeled as someone who is not that smart or who needs a lot of support? So throughout elementary and middle school, because I grew up with that self-loathing, I didn't really try. And as I got into middle school and high school, I had a lot of horrible things happen. I was getting bullied. There was like a situation where it was a hate crime because of my race. And I remember just feeling so miserable and feeling so bad about myself that I just dreamed of like going to college, because I was like, this is going to be my fresh start. I won't be known as this kid who's not intelligent, or this kid who's awkward or who's weird. Like, this is going to be my escape. So I would work really, really hard at school. I would like leave my phone at home so I wouldn't get distracted. I'd stay behind at the school library, and I would try so hard, but I was still getting B's or like failing tests. And, but I still wanted to push myself. I would advocate really hard to be able to be in higher levels, or I'd advocate really hard to be even have an extracurricular. I remember I was so happy the first time I could take an art class, because they were just putting me in support classes thinking I couldn't handle it. And then eventually when I got into college, I was like, okay, I have to work really hard. And in the back of my mind, because insecurities don't always come from nowhere. They come from other people's opinions sometimes. Like, as someone who's worked with kids, I rarely see an insecure toddler or kindergartner, but it's words we hear and like voices that we hear putting ourselves down. So in the back of my mind, I would hear things like that teachers would say or people around me. Because when I got into UMass Lowell, a teacher told me that she was surprised that I could even go to a four-year college. And because they were pushing me to go to a community college, which is a great option for other people, but that didn't align with what I wanted to do. So I'd hear these voices, or voices that I wasn't smart enough or intelligent enough, or that I was weird. So anytime that I felt that I wasn't doing well, I was like, oh my God, they're right. Or there'd be a day where I needed to take a day off of work, and I was telling my friend, and I was like, oh no, I don't want my boss to think I'm lazy, because everyone knows me as someone who's being lazy, like the lazy kid. And my friend was like, Fahad, nobody thinks you're lazy. It's okay to take time for yourself. And as I was working hard and being involved in student government, I eventually then got a job as a well-being leader. And I was having a lot of conversations with students where they were feeling so down about themselves, or they were putting themselves down. And I just wanted to hug them and be like, you are worthy, you are valuable, you are amazing, and you can't let voices of other people put you down. And it inspired me to write an article about the time I failed the math MCAS, because I had so much anxiety about taking tests, and I failed, and it like caused me to have a lot of, you know, self-hatred. And when I wrote that article, so many people connected with me. And it just showed that everything happened for a reason, because my disability is hidden. Not a lot of people can tell I have ADHD, or that I have depression, or I have a neurological disability. So when I shared it, it opened that conversation, which I think was really important. And as I opened up, as I became student trustee, and I was going to these events, and last year was a very hard year. I had like lost the election. I had some health issues. And I started to realize that my mind was getting very dark. Depression doesn't always show up to people when they're teenagers. It sometimes happens when people in their early 20s. And there were so many things that have happened, like the issues of my hate crime or getting bullied or dealing with a lot of things that I suppressed. And the body always keeps count. And it got so bad that one time I got so depressed and I wasn't talking about it or telling anyone about, my body physically went numb and I was barely holding on to the railings. I had to go home for a week to just fully recover. And that was like a wake up call that, you know, I needed to take care of myself, that I can't allow what happened to me to make me feel that I need to push myself to work and work. And that's where coming, writing articles about my stories or making videos or connecting with students and sharing my story, like it makes people feel less alone and we kind of really need each other more than ever. And I always say that like your disability is a part of who you are, but don't ever put limits onto yourself, because I had my expectations for me growing up were so low that even me going to college was surprising. And to be able to do that feels rewarding. And I always tell people, like, aim for the stars. Do not let other people's perceptions hold you back. And there is healing in the breaking, because I think about if these things didn't happen to me, I don't know if I'd be the best disability peer coach I can be, because it makes me be able to empathize and share my stories. And it made me more of a stronger and resilient person. And I think, you know, vulnerability is a strength. It's so much easier to be like, I'm doing good, I'm doing great. But when we are vulnerable and we're open, it really allows others to feel less alone. So yeah, that is my story.
Hi everyone, my name is Brian. I use he, him pronouns. I am an undergraduate admissions counselor here in our office upstairs. And my disability definitely centers around learning aspect of school. I grew up in Westchester County, New York. My parents, great people. I have an older brother as well. They always wanted me to value the Catholic education aspect of life. So from first grade to about sixth grade, I went to a Catholic elementary school. And I was a type of student who was struggling a lot with failing tests and all these different learning strategies that really affected kind of my overall aspect of getting the best education possible in that school. And there was one learning facilitator in the school for everyone in the building, which definitely for 1 to 8th grade has a lot to kind of do. They only worked half days, so kind of pulling kids out of classes to go down there was definitely a struggle. And I think for me, the biggest difficulty I had in that capacity was groups of us were getting pulled out of class to go to a separate location. And a bunch of, we had our support group with the people that we would walk down to the convent with to kind of go to those classes with. But then walking back up, I feel like a lot of us always had that bias or the negativity in our brains of what is the class thinking about us as we walk up here. And I think the best thing for me was I knew that I had my 5 little buddies that we got to walk up and down the halls with, kind of go through that process together. And again, I think the big thing for me was my parents didn't really understand that I had a disability or not really wanting to take the next steps to get the support, because they wanted the best for myself and making sure that I was going to be as successful as possible. So trying to hide that was definitely a struggle. But it wasn't until 2nd, 3rd grade that I actually ended up getting tested for learning disability, and the Catholic elementary school could not afford to test me on site. So my parents actually had to find an outside resource to navigate that process. And I think for them, that was definitely kind of a sign of, is this the right place for our son to be if the resources aren't going to be there for me? So I got tested, and the woman that was testing me was saying to my parents, like, there's a great district here in Westchester, White Plains, that he can go to get all the supports we need for him. But my parents were like, we want him to get that Catholic education. And it wasn't until the 5th grade that my dad was starting to kind of take me on tours of the school district. And I kept saying to them, I've been in a class with 28 kids my whole life. I don't want to go to a district with people that I don't know. So again, it took a while to kind of do that. So I did middle school, half of it at our Catholic elementary school, 5th, 6th. And in 7th grade, they were like, it's time. Let's make this change. So I ended up actually leaving my school in the end of 6th grade and having this, again, small class of 28 kids. Everyone was like, why are you going to the middle school? What's going on? Like, there's do not like us, we like you, like kind of all these different things that definitely were played a huge aspect on my life. And so I ended up going to the middle school, and it was super, super awesome. I had great supports in place. I was not, my mom wasn't coming home from work at 2 o'clock every day to help me with homework and stuff, kind of changing that whole aspect. Having a resource room was something that I found to be really a huge impact, and having a learning facilitator that actually worked in the building from the day the time school started to the time school ended or beyond. And that was super awesome. I was definitely like, felt like I was not alone in that process. And again, seeing other kids go to that space was something that was awesome. When we were really understanding the concepts of how to be a student, how to study for a test, how to navigate things that I was not getting supported in my Catholic elementary school. So that was super awesome. I feel like it definitely changed my perspective on myself as a person, but also myself as a student in my classes, and really kind of challenging myself to take the next steps kind of at my future. And again, kind of fast forward to eighth grade, it was that time to say White Plains High School or Catholic High School. And my dad, my brother, and my whole family had a huge connection to our local Catholic high school in town. And when it came time to decide where I was going, my parents had our final IEP 504 meeting with the learning facilitator in the White Plains district. And she had said to my dad, he's not going to survive at the Catholic high school. And my dad was kind of like, can we give him a shot? And she was like, no. So the first time my dad was like, I'm just not going to listen to you. We're going to enroll him into the school because this is how this is going to work. And my dad had gotten in contact with the math teacher that was learning facilitator at the Catholic high school at the time, the dean of enrollment, and the assistant principal there, and basically reassuring this facilitator that I was going to go and that I was going to be successful. So that was kind of nice to kind of, again, have your parent really support you through the process, and don't let people doubt kind of your strengths and weaknesses there. So I went to Catholic high school, and I think the time that I spent in 2 years at the elementary or at the middle school really prepared me to set goals for myself. Again, I think a lot of us touched upon advocating for ourselves and making sure that the teachers in the building knew that I wanted to be here for 4 years. I wanted to graduate from here and go on to college. And it took a while, I think, for me to kind of settle into that space and start advocating for what was on my plan for my academics. But I think I took that second to educate myself on what I needed to be the best I could be. So I ended up graduating from Catholic high school, and that was super awesome for me, I think, as an individual, but for the people that kind of saw that change from seventh grade to all the way to high school, because a lot of the boys that I went to Catholic elementary school with followed me into high school. And I think the nice thing was they were like, your disability is definitely one that is seen, but it's proven that you know how to advocate for yourself. And flash forward to high school graduation, I decided I was going to kind of take the next steps of moving away from New York to kind of figure out where I was going. My guidance counselor was very much like, you shouldn't go far away from home because you're going to end up coming home, and this is kind of not going to work in your favor. And I was really, again, trying to advocate to challenge myself to take the next steps to where I wanted to be. And it came time, one meeting I said to her, I was like, I'm going to go where I'm going to go, and you're going to either accept it or not, and we don't need to see each other again if that's going to be the case. So I ended up applying to a bunch of schools at home, but also here in Massachusetts, and ended up enrolling at Merrimack. All credit to Jody over here. I went to graduated from high school, went to Merrimack, and she looked at my dad at the end of kind of before I was going and was like, he's not going to last there. He's not going to make it out of there. And I think we kind of had that process of, not you. My guidance counselor said to my dad, I'm not going to make it out of there. And my dad was like, we're going to make it out of there. So he connected with Accessibility Services over at Merrimack, and we're like, this is where he wants to be. This is 4 years of his journey. And I think Merrimack was really a school that I guided myself through kind of my process. I got involved on campus, really making sure that being an out-of-state student, I wanted to be there. I wanted to stay on campus. And I really advocated for my disability at Merrimack, seeing Jody and her team when she was there. And again, the turnover when she left was super awesome. Everyone was super supportive and really making sure that, again, I had all the services I needed while I was a student on campus. And after first semester, freshman year, I, believe it or not, made the dean's list, and sending that to my parents was something that my dad started to question. He was like, is this truly who you are? Is this real? And I was like, yep, I put a lot of focus on my academics in the classroom. I did switch my major a few times, but again, I think Merrimack allowed me to discover really what I wanted to do and where I wanted to be. And I think that kind of as I navigate the process of working in higher ed, it's something that when students come right to my table at a college fair and say, I have a disability, it's always the first place is navigating the disability services here at the university and saying, this is a place that you're going to really thrive and develop in your classes. And just those overall connections that students want to hear on the road is something that I take a lot of pride in. And I'm not afraid to tell students about my disability and kind of how I navigated that. And I think, again, I always relate to Jody. I say she worked at my previous institution. I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for Merrimack. So again, just kind of having those connections with the teams here at the university to navigate that with students is something that I get really excited to talk to students about. And I think that we relate to each other when we're having those conversations. And I think it's the comfort level of talking to someone that has kind of gone through some similarities and differences in the process is something that students want to hear. And I think that I'm trying to educate my team upstairs a lot on this process. I think a lot of us kind of people have their biases and they have their opinions on things. But I think, again, being here today and kind of continuing the process is something that I'm trying to share to our team, the importance of bringing you guys upstairs to our office to educate us on the process. And I know it's in the works as well. So excited to kind of see that coming. But just the university level in general is one that I think students should not be afraid to advocate for your disabilities at all. So that's me.
Right, so that was the last of our in-person panelists, and we have Kai joining us virtually. So Kai, you can go ahead and unmute yourself. And
yep. Hi, my name is Kai Sweetland. Let me just put my speech because I am going to mute it. All right. Hi, my name is Kai Sweetland again. I wanted to start by thanking everyone who worked with me and offered me this opportunity. And secondly, I'd like to ask for your patience. I am currently receiving infusion treatments right this second, and I can become confused or I have adrenal dysfunction as well. So I can get all over the place sometimes. So I'm going to try to stay on track. So I wanted to start talking about kind of the diagnoses I have now. We're still in the process of understanding exactly what's happening. My doctors are more focused on helping me feel better. And honestly, looking at the history, they all kind of come together and agree, but we need specialists to diagnose me with connective tissue disorders. But I have an autoimmune disease that attacks my body. I have dysautonomia, which is a dysfunction of the autonomic system. And I have POTS that we know of. And there is a suspected secondary autoimmune disorder that is affecting nerves. And I have nerve damage all over my body and my legs. So it can make it very difficult to get around and to sometimes communicate my needs. So with that little background, I only recently got this diagnosis. And so going through this process of getting sicker in middle school and high school was really difficult because when it's hard to explain of what's happening to yourself and when you don't even know what's happening to, explain to other people when you don't know what's happening to yourself. And it was even harder to advocate for my needs when I didn't know what I needed. And then I did know what I needed. And then the new fight came where I tried to advocate for myself. And I had people who didn't believe I was really sick. Back in middle school, I went to my primary care and I got told that I was overweight and that I needed to lose at least 90 pounds. And that would help all of my joint dislocations, my continuous fractures. I have broken many bones. And then communicating to my friends what was happening, why I could no longer go out and play soccer and why I couldn't go out and eat these foods anymore, and explain that as a young kid, I am struggling, was so hard. And I honestly don't think I ever learned how to properly communicate that until senior year of high school. And as I got sicker, my mom, who has the same condition as me, helped me understand what was happening because she experienced the same situation. And I convinced myself when I got into high school and I was first facing these issues of, okay, I'm sick. I need to advocate for myself. What do? Who do I talk to? I convinced myself it really wasn't that bad. And when I got restriction after restriction and treated like an immature child in response, I convinced myself I wasn't communicating in the right way, that I wasn't doing the right things, or I was presenting myself in a way that made me seem unreliable. And that all came to a head for me when I was officially turning in paperwork for wheelchair usage in high school. I had all the legal paperwork from my primary care physician. I was going through a almost 2-month program at Boston Children's with Harvard doctors who was signing off on my condition, trying to make life more manageable for me. And they thought a wheelchair would be helpful, but I was told that what I was doing was not enough and that I needed to quote unquote get a wheelchair note from a wheelchair doctor. It wasn't until that, along with constant misunderstandings in my work life, which led me to getting fired, and my social life, which made me lose a lot of my friends, it left me feeling very neglected in a lot of corners and utterly alone. And it wasn't until a year after I completed high school when I rejoined college, because I was in college my sophomore and junior year of high school, because I assumed as I got sicker, maybe I would need to take a break, and that these courses could come in handy when I decide to come back to class. And I wanted to last as long as possible. I was halfway through my associate's degree when I decided that it was best for my health if I took a step back. So when I rejoined college this freshman year, I learned something very important. It wasn't that I wasn't advocating in the right way. It wasn't that I was speaking in the wrong way. I did everything right. We live in a society that stigmatizes disabilities, both in higher education and in general. That stigma made faculty, staff, and administrators feel comfortable rejecting me over and over again. They told me it was so hard to believe because I just looked fine. So when I came back to college, I swore that that would never happen to me again, and that the skills I had learned, I wasn't going to let happen to other students either. I reached out to my teachers, the main staff, administrators, and faculty that I worked with. I interacted with the police department to spread awareness about these disabilities, because one of the main reasons why I got fired was because my neurological disorder presents in slurring words and stumbling, and that looks like intoxication. So, without the ability to explain what was happening at the time, I lost my job. So from that, I learned that maybe it was best to go around and spread as much knowledge as I could. I wanted to establish relationships, understanding, and again, spread knowledge. And I faced complications and we overcame them. And I found that more often than not, the people that you work with directly want to make the most change. They just feel limited or are limited in their capabilities. But so much change has come about talking about issues or important fear factors, concerns around campus. From this communication, we have regularly working elevator access in the dining halls for disabled students now. We have accessible entryways to and around Duggan Hall, which is one of the most hard buildings to access for wheelchair users because of the ramp. Now they have put one in the back where you can enter on flat ground, and in front building accessing other halls like Reed Hall. Regular repairs and maintenance of push buttons for aided users and so much more. The communication of faculty and staffy has increased so much. And some of you guys or some people who might watch this recording later might recognize me from reaching out about your experiences as students and about your struggles with accommodations, with accessibility and disability services. You guys have gave your input on what you would like to hear me speak about today. So the speech has come together with a lot of people's input. And to be honest, the reason why I've been reaching out about everyone's experiences is slightly a selfish reason, honestly. I can't fight alone, and I need communication between everybody. Higher education can be a place of growth and opportunity, but for disabled students, it often requires extra labor, filling out endless paperwork and accommodations, advocating for accessibility, and proving over and over that we belong. And too often, we are seen as burdens instead of individuals with potentials. Professors and administrators sometimes view accommodations as special treatment rather than what they are, necessary tools for equity. And this is an important fact that someone really wanted me to talk about. Equality and equity go hand in hand. They are not opposites, they are pieces of the same puzzle. Equality is about giving everyone the same opportunities, but that only works if everyone starts from the same place. Equity recognizes that some people face more barriers than others and gives them the support that they need to succeed. Think about it like a race. If one person starts 10 steps behind, treating everyone the same won't make it fair. They need a little extra help to catch up. And when we focus on equity, we're making sure equality isn't just an idea, but a reality for everyone. Beyond the classroom, disability shapes every aspect of life. The job market still favors non-disabled over handicapped candidates. Social spaces often exclude us, and many of us face stigma in daily interaction. And even though the ADA protects us, enforcement is inconsistent, especially in this time and age, and accessibility is frequently treated as an afterthought. I would like to take a second to remind you, though, for any students especially listening, the best thing that you can do is keep speaking, to keep advocating and keep making change. And as I said before, people want help. That's why they're in that job, but they may need help getting something along. And that brings me to one of my key and final points. I'll try to close this off real quick. Communication is the key to accommodation and accessibility. Disability is not a tragedy. Our real problem is not with our bodies, our mind, but the barriers society places before us in ableism. Disability is a natural, diverse part of human life, and inclusion benefits everyone. And a truly accessible world is one where no one has to ask for accommodations because they're already built into the system. If nothing else you take from my speech today, please take this as an example of just what we are capable of if given the right tools to showcase our capabilities. Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you to all of our panelists for being incredibly vulnerable and sharing your stories. We so appreciate it. Thank you. Oh, no, I'm going to move. We're going to move my laptop down. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Hello. One more minute, I think. Okay.